Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
Hi.
How's it going?
Long time no see.
It has been a while, hasn't it?
Yeah. You know, you were. I tried to do one late last week, and you were off to a convention in Michigan, and Stephen Hackett was gonna sneak in and do one. And then that didn't work either. So nothing. Oh, you know, we're back now. Here we are. I've made the long commute to my office for this podcast.
Do you
which is to say,
train? Is there some sort of wheeled conveyance?
Well, the biggest
takes you there.
The biggest. There could be a wheeled conveyance. I could like stand on a board or something. It's morning. It's early, and I was still like drinking my tea and stuff. But
yeah, this is an early podcast.
I had to move the blanket.
Oof.
Oof. I had to put on some slippers. Yeah, I know. It's pretty rough stuff.
Yeah, I hear that. I've got the I had to turn on the space heater.
Oh yeah.
It's a little chilly here.
Yeah, sure.
I had to put on a hoodie. Yeah.
I got you. I'm there. I got all those things too. I got the space heater.
I was about to say, it's Monday morning. I realized, damn, it's Tuesday morning.
Yeah, nice try.
I lose track of these.
Well, no, you go away for the weekend like that too, and it's easy to lose track of and feel like you're in a weird. It puts you off your axis. It upsets your. It discombobulates you. How about that?
Yeah. The good news is I'm not going anywhere until Friday. So you know.
Oh, wow.
Well, so then I should be right back shade. On. I should be right back on my axis and just in time to get knocked off again.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's how it works. So good job. What's going on? I have follow up.
Oh, on this show? Do we do that?
I don't know. It's sort of
is this about the Comcast stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, follow up. What's
people? I heard from people who are like, "Whoa, what about this? And what about that? And everybody lives to solve a mystery." I have a great follow up. So I'm using Peak Hour, which is this utility I found that has been pretty useful at giving me some. Basically, like seeing when my children wake up and go to sleep and how much data they're streaming in the meantime.
Please,
right?
Please tell me that somehow that app is responsible for your crazy gigabytes of downloads, because that would be hilarious.
Well, it's not directly responsible, but something funny happened. So those huge, massive inflows and outflows of data that I talked about last time, where at 2 a.m, stuff was... suddenly, you know, huge outflows of data and inflows of data like that make no sense. How could that possibly be? And I was looking at I unplugged all the devices that I thought might do something like that, like game consoles and stuff, overnight. Sure. And I did all this stuff. I rebooted everything. I did all this stuff. And what I discovered, I had this theory, which was, I wonder if they're not real. I wonder if those huge outflows of data, and I have had a couple since then, are fake. If they are something that that is, because I've had some, in fact, I'm looking here, I've had some in the last couple of days. I've had these same, like, at 1 a.m., there was a, you know, there was 40 gigs transferred, and at 2 a.m., there was another 40 gigs transferred, and keeping in mind that, you know, although I do online backup, I can see the data there, and it's not.
You would have to be changing, right? Like, I mean, it only backs up what's been changed. You'd have to be changing huge swaths of files.
Exactly. So what I did was I calculated out what would those days have looked like without those 2 hours, or, you know, those bursts at two and three in the morning. What would the traffic have looked like? Because the way Peak Hour works is it's talking to my router.
Right.
And the router is giving through a standard protocol, is giving like data statistics. And so I thought, what if they were normal days instead of weird days? How far off would I be? And I got a number. It was like, at that point, it was like those spikes were representing like 280 gigabytes of data. These spikes over what would be an average day.
Right.
So then I went to Comcast's web-based tool, which is basically showing me the number that Comcast would claim is what I'm using.
Right. And they should know.
They should know, although there's always a question of, like, how do they know, what are they measuring, and all of that. But that's coming. That's what's flowing out through the cable modem, not what's passing through my router. So I thought it's possible that the router is confused. And the number that Comcast thought that I had used was exactly the number that peak hour thought I had used minus the spikes. Yeah. So those usage spikes are either a complete data aberration or something very weird going on my internal network that somehow is being counted as an outflow, even though it's not.
Well, even on your internal network, that's a huge amount of data to be transferred.
Something
would have to be going on.
And no devices. I mean, it would literally have to be something that was just endless, gets caught in an endless loop. And even then, I'm not quite sure how it could do that. So I think it's a statistical aberration. I think there is something weird going on either in the app or in the router where it is thinking, you know, it's counting things wrong and everything is getting confused. Because as of today, I looked it up yesterday. As of today, peak hour thinks I've used 1.3 terabytes because we're getting to the end of the month now, right?
Okay, yeah.
And don't get me wrong. I have used 1.2 terabytes before, but we were gone for a week. shouldn't not this month. Like, I shouldn't have to do this month. I shouldn't have to worry about hitting a terabyte this month. Next month, I'm probably going to have to pay them to upgrade because I'm going to hit a terabyte. But here's the thing. So at this point, and this didn't happen last month. That's the other weird thing. I don't know quite what changed here, but peak hour thinks I've used 1.3 terabytes. Xfinity thinks I have used 568 gigabytes. Well, that's accurate.
yeah. I was going to say, that's a bit of a difference there.
Unfortunately, what this means is that I can't really rely on this app to tell me my data usage, although at least I can. I mean, the goal wasn't to do that. The Comcast number actually seems to be quite accurate. It might be delayed by about 24 hours, but it's pretty accurate. Yeah. So what it really has informed me more than anything else is, like, when the real data is being used and it's not seeing one of these spikes, what's happening? And the answer is, you know, it's mostly my kids streaming video, and we've changed the rate at which they stream. I've changed their video quality on their Netflix settings, for example. And I think I'm going to buy my son YouTube Red because it allows sort of background audio use, and so much of what he does on YouTube is actually just listening to audio. And if you put it in background, it's not streaming the video anymore, I believe, and that lowers the bandwidth. So there's stuff like that is going on. But in the end, you know, I may just give up and give them the money, because it might be worth it not only to not pay overage fees, but to not worry about this.
Yep.
Because it's stupid.
It's funny, you know, it's funny that you're running into this problem, because I actually ran into something similar when I got I came back from India and I got my bill and noticed my heating bill was like $150. I was gone for 6 weeks. I'm like, how is that possible? Like, I'm not going to lie. My house is old. It's drafty. I was pretty sure I turned the heat down before I left, and it claimed I'd used like 100 therms or something for the month. And I was like, that seems insane. It seems insane. But I don't have the same capability to like debug this and figure it out, because I only have a certain amount of control over my utilities. But it was I understand the feeling of like, oh man, I want to get to the bottom of this mystery. Like you said, everybody loves a mystery. But it's sometimes it's more practical than others.
Yeah, so I don't know what I'm going to do. I mean, I'm encouraged by the fact that we're going to be down in the, you know, 650 gigabyte area but I think next month, when we've got a full month in residence, instead of missing, you know, probably like 25% almost of the days, that we're going to be back over again. But that's on us, and Comcast is dumb to have bandwidth caps. I have no, to answer some other questions that I've gotten about this, I have no other options for high-speed internet. So, you know, I've heard a bunch of people I had one guy very helpfully tell me on Twitter, he was like, Time Warner Cable doesn't have bandwidth caps. I said, congratulations.
Yeah, people don't understand how cable companies work and that they're, you know, largely regional and there's extreme limits on competition in many different areas.
There is a, I've said this on podcasts before, there is not too far away from me some AT&T fiber, but my understanding is that, you know, nobody's investing in that infrastructure anymore. And so right. even though there is fiber like across the freeway, it's not gonna, and I'm right by the freeway, it's not gonna come over here. So,
oh, sure. Yeah.
So that's, and who knows? I mean, that they might have other issues too, but yeah. So, and I've had a bunch of people ask about Comcast Business, which is unlimited. That's true, but the Comcast Business rates are all actually quite expensive too.
It's very not cheap.
It would be, it's cheaper for me to piggyback on the single residential internet and just pay $50. And the way I do it is the Incomparable Incorporated basically chips in for part of my cable bill, my personal cable bill, because the business needs access to the internet. So it's all okay, but still, it's
Comcast raised my bill this year. I noticed when I went to pay it, which is a little annoying because I have one of those, like, I tried very hard to get off, like, the promotional rates and, like, all the deals because I was like, you know what? I just don't want to have to make this argument every time. And I have my own cable modem, so I don't lease a cable modem, and I just get internet access and so all that. And still, you know, they charge inflation, right? They start charging you more, or they, so it's like, I don't know, I think I pay another $5 to $10 a month now, which is not nothing, but it's annoying. But you know, we all keep using more bandwidth as part of it. That's, right, like,
well, that's the trick, is that one of the things that I've heard from people is that this is Comcast doing this, it's very clever because they're doing it where they claim that 1% of their customers use more than a terabyte. And I've heard a bunch of people say, well, that includes a vast swath of customers who use nothing, and they're suppressing the real number. But I think that's not the game that they're playing. I'm going to take them at their word that it's a small number of us. I mean, I have two teenagers streaming video, and I'm running an internet-based business. Okay, yeah, we use a lot of data. I get that we might be outliers. But by putting the caps in place now, you know what they're doing, and I heard this from a bunch of people, and they're absolutely right, is what they're doing is getting the cap in now before everybody's streaming 4K video and right. other stuff, yeah. right? Because usage only is going to go
coming.
Up.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and over time, if we've seen any indication from the cellular providers, they'll probably ratchet it up, right? Eventually, it'll be like a terabyte and a half.
Sure.
You know, like, they'll just keep moving. It's a sliding scale because everybody's is going to go up, and they're going to have to adjust.
I'm a little surprised that Comcast is doing this as an all or nothing, because the other way for them to do this would have been to say, our standard model is 5 or is half a terabyte, and then you can pay this and get a terabyte and pay this and get 2. And they haven't done that. They basically said you can pay $50 a month extra and you get everything. Now, I would be shocked if in a year or two they don't say, we don't mean unlimited, right?
Yeah. We mean quote-unquote unlimited.
That actually, now $50 gets you 2 terabytes.
Right.
And if you want to, and above that, you have to pay overages because you're abusing the network or something. But I don't know. It's a funny business. And remember, wireless used to, you know, the iPhone came with unlimited data, sure. and then people started using data, and they're like, whoa, hey, now.
Yeah, well, and of course, now the people who are grandfathered into those plans have seen their plans go up over time, because
sure.
AT&T very much wants to get people off those plans. I was just looking because I was curious. I also have Comcast. I have used 221 gigabytes so far this month, so that's not a lot.
That's not a lot.
Somehow I used a lot I used a lot while I was gone. I think that's because I kept using my server to download things uh-huh. while I was in India.
I'm looking at my Comcast has the compare the last 3 months. So just for records keeping here, in October we used 1.19 terabytes of data. 1.2 terabytes. In November we used 1.14 terabytes. In December we used 1.07 terabytes, and this month we're using, so far we have used 568 gigabytes in, let's say, 23 days, which over the, it, that, you know, that's going to mean we're going to land at like 7:40, which is great until you realize we weren't here from the first until the 8th. So, you know, I think we use a terabyte a month. I think we do. And it's just unfortunate. If it was 1.5, I'd be like, oh, well, forget it. And if it was 0.8, I'd be like, all right, we're good. But I'm right on the line. So I think we're just going to have to pay
and deal. It's clear that, I mean, you know, like you said, four people in a house with various applications, especially the two kids who are at that age where they're like doing their own stuff. Because I look at my highest amount was November, and it was 444 gigabytes. And it's like, I'm only one person. I'm a very intensive person because I'm here a lot, and I use the internet a lot.
Too. Yeah,
but yeah, if you put three more people in here, we would be screwed.
You'd be in trouble. Yeah. Well, anyway, that's my mystery solved.
Yeah,
I guess
it's funny because I'm on a couple of years ago I switched to a family plan for cellular. And the main reason for doing that was to move my parents both to iPhones, because my mom had an iPhone on AT&T, but it was a separate plan. And my dad, we wanted to get him on an iPhone because he was still using a like pay-as-you-go cell phone. And I figured out eventually like it would be cheaper to move my mom and myself to the same plan. So we now have like the three of us on a 6 gigabyte plan. And I laugh every month when I look at the bill because, you know, I use a lot of data. And it's generally like, I use 4 or 5 gigs. My parents use like 200 megabytes. It's fascinating to see that and see the breakdown of people's consumption habits, right? Because, you know, they're at home a lot using Wi-Fi. They don't travel as much. My dad does not use his phone for anything, maybe making a phone call now and then. But he certainly doesn't. I don't think he even knows how to use email or anything. And my mom uses it a little bit, but not a lot. So 6 gigabytes is okay right now, but you know, a few years ago I had 5, you know, and I was okay with that. And I remember having 2 or something. So, you know, it goes up, right? Like keeps going up.
Yeah. We trained our kids, especially my daughter, cause my son mostly is using Wi-Fi, even though he has a phone that's sort of like the, where is he and can we get in touch with him? But she's a full-on teenager, and she uses her phone a lot. And we had to train her on being aware of using cell data and, like, download songs and stuff when you're on Wi-Fi. Don't use cell data. Because the first couple months she had the phone, we had serious data problems. And the funny thing is we don't have cellular data problems anymore, right? Like, that we have evangelized that pretty well for her, and me being not out of the house as much means I'm using a lot less than I used to. So those that all goes together, it's all kind of worked out. But what we've done is optimized for Wi-Fi data usage, and now we have a cap on the Wi-Fi data usage. It's like, all right, so we can evangelize that and say, well, it worked with cellular, so now we'll evangelize it here. But what we don't have is a place to punt all the data usage. Like, there's nowhere else to go.
You can't punt it back to some.
No, well, no, probably not. Right.
You say if you're gonna keep streaming 4K video, log on to our neighbor's Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Well, and you see the dissociation here of wireless, because theoretically LTE could be like a competitor to cable internet. Right. But what are we talking about here? You know, the cap for our cellular plan is like 6 gigabytes, and the cap for my cable plan is 1 terabyte. So they're not really close now.
No, not at all.
Oh well, internet, it's dumb. I hate counting bytes. Right.
I just don't want to do it.
I hate counting in general. All right, math is bad. That's what
my understanding. There would be no math.
You're sounding more and more like my daughter all the time. She doesn't not a fan of the math either. I tell her she loves science, and I'm like, you need the math for the science. She's like, but I don't like the math. I'm like, yeah, but you need it for the science. What else is going on?
Well, it's a little quiet now.
Quiet.
I mean, it's January.
It is. I had that moment. I was on iOS today with Leo Laporte yesterday, and we were looking at the news stories, and we're like, I just said, Leo, it's January.
there's not much.
Nothing happening. I did do that. I did do that case for the 10.5 inch iPad Pro story, and I actually brought that up on iOS today, yesterday as well, and on Upgrade, because I'm kind of a believer in it now, because I like the I like the math, the idea that it's basically the pixels of the big iPad Pro at the resolution of the mini. Dan Provost.
Dan Provost at team at Studio Neat. Yeah, I like it too. I think the only thing that befuddles me about this story, and I mainly attribute this to weird sourcing of rumors, is that they're like, oh yeah, maybe they'll keep the 9.7 inch around. Okay, I can understand keeping the current version of the iPad Pro, 9.7 inch Pro, around.
Like in the price list.
Yeah, you kill it, knock it down $100 or whatever, like you're going to do. Keep it there. Making new 9.7 inches alongside new 10.5 or whatever makes zero sense to me. A 0.8 inch screen difference is not a differentiator.
Well, in fact, the screens are so similar that you
could fit the same chassis.
Fit it. I mean,
effectively the same chassis.
It fits in the footprint. Now, whether you could actually engineer something with that small a bezel and all that, whether Apple could do that or not, is an open question.
Yeah, but even if you adjust it like a little bit,
it's going to be very similar.
Yeah, exactly. Those two things seem identical in terms of the market they're addressing to me. So I don't see any reason they would do new versions of both. I think they will kick the 9.7 inch down to a cheaper price, and the 10.5 inch will replace it as sort of the mid-range Pro, and you'll still have the mini, the mid-range model, and the 12.9.
I'm not saying this is going to happen, but I feel like the right configuration, if this product exists, I feel like the right configuration for the iPad line is iPad mini, iPad Air, 10.5 Pro, 12.9 Pro. I'm not sure there needs to be a 9.7 Pro. Like, is that the Air? Is there, you know?
But is the differentiation between the 9.7 Pro and the 9.7 Air strong enough?
Right.
9.7, I mean, is the 9.7 Air and the 10.5 Pro, if you want to say that, is that a significant enough differentiation? Like, again, it seems tough to make a brand new Air.
There are no new Airs, right? Do they make a new Air, or do they just kind of say, well, yeah, this iPad Pro is still here? And that's the question, is the iPad Air a line, or is it just a remaindered old model and will just kind of fade away and everything's going to be an iPad Pro?
I think very much like the MacBook Air, that the iPad Air is probably a dead brand.
Yeah.
Because I think Air is going away. I mean, except for AirPods,
that's true.
But that's a separate thing, but... that implies something that the iPad Air nor the MacBook Air and the iPad Air are silly because they, you know, when you look, just dissect that branding a little bit, you remember that the reason that they started that was because they were supposed to be super light, right?
Right.
And it's like, well, they're all super light now. It doesn't really matter anymore.
I think the reason the Air and the Mini exist is for the price. And that could be, you know, replaced by something else. I guess it bugs me that you'd have a thing called a Pro and there is no iPad. There's no other iPad. I mean, does the iPad Mini... The iPad Mini exists only in opposition to the iPad Pro. That's the weird thing about it, is by calling it the iPad Pro, I want there to be a non-Pro hanging out there.
Just call the 10.5 the iPad then. I don't know. They're problem solved.
So all of my objections to it now are about the details of how they sell this product line and they differentiate it so it isn't super confusing. But the product itself, I mean, you could also argue that a lot of people don't want that many pixels and they don't want, everything looks a little bit smaller and all of that, right? And they don't want that. They just want the 9.7 and that's good enough for them. But my choice would be to say that that's Pro resolution. And that those two models, the 12.9 and this 10.5, are Pro resolution. The iPad Pro has this resolution, and the other iPads have this other resolution, and kind of leave it at that. But again, we have a 9.7 iPad Pro that is not that, so I don't know quite where they're going there.
I also find resolution to be a tricky thing to sell computers based on, because once you get past the sort of basic, people for whom that actually makes a difference, most people can't figure out what that means.
Yeah, I just mean sort of like more internally, just the idea that this is what makes an iPad Pro an iPad Pro. Maybe the answer is this ability to run two full-size iPad apps side by side, and that's what it is.
With a really crappy interface for managing two apps.
That's the missing piece, right? There are rumors about that, but they're kind of old and we haven't heard anything new, but I can't imagine, I guess I can imagine all sorts of terrible things, but if you're going to roll out new iPad Pros, you got to roll out an iOS update software that does. I mean, you have to address the issues. I give them a mulligan on iOS 10 for iPad. I like the idea of them delaying iPad-only features until the spring when the iPads come out. I think that's a great strategy if that's their strategy. But if new iPads come out and there's just no new iPad features until iOS 11, that is not good, because those features seemed half-baked when they shipped with iOS 9, but I think we all figured, well, this will get us through a year, and then they will have a new version of this that works better.
Plus, we were dying of thirst in the desert, right?
Yes, right.
Like, so they gave us
this muddy water doesn't taste very good, but I'll drink
but
it.
It'll keep me alive. Keep me going. I don't know. It's so what, we get like an iOS 10.5. I know the rumor is 10.3, right? But like, you get like an iOS midstream update. They've done that before, but it's been a while. They don't tend to roll out a lot of new features outside of major version releases in the last year or two or more. I think wasn't it 4.3 when the iPad came out that actually brought like iPad specific features, something like that, way back in the day. Then since then they've really generally relegated major feature additions to the big version releases.
Right.
I don't think that's necessarily a great plan. I support them rolling out feature updates in midstream revisions, because it takes a lot of the pressure off those big releases. Right?
Yeah, right.
And that's been one of the complaints about Apple over the last few years, is that they overburden themselves a bit by trying to hit a year deadline. Right? Software development isn't a one-size-fits-all thing, right? It's not like, oh, no matter what you're doing, you can build it in a year. Like, that's not how that works.
No.
So it's weird to put it on this artificial schedule whereby every year, roughly the same time, there's a major update, because some things take longer and some things don't take as long. So why should you wait and group them all together? I mean, sometimes some features depend on other features, right? So like, there is a convenient, bundling them together makes sense if you're trying to give a bunch of features that are all interrelated in some ways, but sometimes they're not.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't know. I
was always a believer in
schedule,
in the idea that the iPad was never going to get focus in the fall, because it's all about the new iPhone. And so like, being realistic about that and saying, you know what? That's true. Let's put the iPad out in the spring when, we can take time to focus on it and not be getting it out there with other products that we're working on. And let's do an iOS release then that takes advantage of those that new hardware, and also add some other nice updates for existing iPad hardware, and we'll move on. Also, you could argue that the focus on iPad Pro, especially as a 12.9 iPad Pro user, like, having another product with that screen resolution is a big help, because right now developers are targeting like a single model, and it's the big Pro, and it's not really, is it worth it to target that model for development? But if you've got this 10.5, then, everybody outside developers as well as Apple can have a better reason to like focus on that interface and make sure that it's really good too. So it all makes sense. The question is just, are they doing that?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the 10.5, I think, is compelling. I mean, as someone who uses a 9.7-inch Air 2, it's great. I don't have any complaints about it. I don't use my iPad that much either, comparatively. But a 10.5, I've seen the 12.9 screens, and while I appreciate the screen real estate involved, I don't need a device that big. And so a 10.5 seems like it could hit a sweet spot for me, where it's like a screen that's a bit bigger than 9.7, a little better resolution, and not huge comparatively.
Yeah, the 12.9 is huge. I mean, it is. It's heavy. Every time I pick up Lauren's iPad Air, I think, oh, this is so much lighter and all that. And then I look at the screen and I'm like, nope, I love that big screen. I just love it. I love what fits on it. I love the fact that split screen is like real. But this 10.5 concept, I'm like, yeah, I might really get behind that. Something that's that much smaller, but still has the ability to do that. I have to see it, right? Because it may be that everything is so small that I'm like, okay, I'm in my mid 40s. I can't see anything there. I need the large print edition. Thanks. Maybe so. I put my glasses all the way down at the bridge of my nose, but I want to see it. But I'm intrigued by that, because it is, 12. The 12.9 is bulky. There's no getting around it. It's a big thing.
Yep. So we'll see. Anything else happening out there?
I mean,
big wide world. Not much.
The music apps got updated. I mean, I have been using Logic with a little bit with a touch bar support. And what I like about it is that it's super customizable. Like, you can customize every button on the touch bar in the Logic interface and assign text and colors and exactly where it goes on the touch bar. And, you know, it's not a great interface to do it, but you can do it. You can make that touch bar look exactly like that. And there's like a virtual piano keyboard or a drum kit that you can put on there if you're doing instrument stuff. But, you know, I use Logic all the time. And I don't think I have enough need to fill the touch bar with all of the shortcuts. But I get, like Mike was saying on Upgrade yesterday, that he does a lot of things in sequence in Logic, where he's like, you know, command this, control this, you know, this. He's like a bunch of keystrokes in a row. And he said he could see the value in just putting those sequences on the touch bar so he could go boop, 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 boop. I get it.
It's interesting that you bring that up as someone. I mean, obviously, I don't use Logic, but I think it's funny that you and I both wrote articles from Macworld last week, I believe, that were about touch interfaces.
Yes,
Like in some ways we wrote things that were maybe not like diametrically opposed, but I think we both attacked a similar problem from different angles.
Yeah.
And I think we both agree, because you wrote something in that article that I had sort of used as a throwaway thought in an article a few months ago, which was a similar idea of the what if the multi-touch trackpad had a screen in it.
Right, right.
And I think for part of me feels like that might make more sense than I haven't spent a lot of time with the touch bar. I've only spent a very small amount of time with the touch bar. But I think a lot of my concerns about the touch bar that remain are the same ones as early on, where I felt like, you know, part of it is just feeling like maybe it doesn't go far enough. Like there's some things there that I think are interesting, but I wonder if, you know, we talk to people a year or two from now after it's had a while to be out there, and I wonder how many people will still be using it for anything beyond, you know, what they were using the F keys for. I'm not convinced that it is it's certainly not a revolutionary feature from my mind. I think it's interesting, but I don't see it being something that really defines the computer as a major touch interface for it.
Well, I mean, I'm split on it. Like, I can see the value in it. I think, one of my things in my piece was about how do you get touch bar elsewhere? And I feel like if touch bar is never anywhere but the MacBook Pro, I mean, forget it. Like, it's just a customized F key.
That's a non-starter.
Right? Yeah. And they're trying to push these, like, oh, you can slide around in the timeline and you can do a keyboard, a piano keyboard and stuff like that. But
it's very limited appeal.
It's going to just be, like, virtual keys. At which point, you might as well do that thing where it's physical keys with those little OLED displays on them, so
yeah,
you can
right,
you can
exactly.
just change what's labeled
at least
on them.
You can do it by touch at that point, as opposed to
right. But
you know,
if it's everywhere, I think it might have some. It might have some more value. But yeah, you know, you do wonder if it's just an esoteric alternative input method. Quite frankly, like the people, you know, we know some people who use graphics tablets as their pointing devices and mm-hmm. they swear by them. And that's great. That's never going to be a mainstream input method. Right. So this may be similarly an esoteric method. The thing that disappoints me about the touch bar is mostly that I feel like it's being used as a keyboard more than it's being used as a touch surface. Like
it's literally emulating physical buttons. And that to me, that seems like it's a faster horse.
That's
right? Like, that's my problem with
that's
it.
Why I mentioned the fact that the Magic Trackpad might be a better place for the touch bar than the keyboard. And I think it goes back to, I wonder what they prototyped, whether they decided it was bad interaction design or whether they decided it wasn't something they could actually build. The idea of, because imagine the MacBook Pro where instead of the touch bar, there is a screen under part of the trackpad. or something like that, right? Yeah, where you're doing a more interactive multi-touch. I don't know if that makes sense either, quite frankly.
Exactly, because the fundamental issue there, and I think it does make some sense, but one of the fundamental issues there is, again, now you have displays in both your vertical and horizontal surfaces, which means
that's a fundamental.
For at least some of it, you're going to have to go back and forth between them.
Yeah, that's a fundamental problem. Although I guess one of the arguments would be that people look down at their keyboard. I know people say that they don't.
Yeah.
But most people do at some point look down at their keyboard, at least to orient. But
but then you're spending a lot more time if you're directly interacting.
And my hands are way closer to my keyboard and trackpad than they are to my screen, to talk about the touchscreen argument. I mean, I think the touchscreen argument, Apple refusing to do a touchscreen Mac, I think your piece about that, I mean, you are right in a lot of ways that Apple is missing out on interactions here. But I think I could also make a lot of the same arguments against a touchscreen Mac as I could against the touch bar, in the sense that I feel like it's really limited. Like, on laptops, which I'll grant you two-thirds of Macs sold are laptops, but on a laptop, the screen is so close that touching it actually kind of makes sense. Yes. On desktops, it doesn't.
Not so much. Yeah, I agree.
I don't want a touchscreen iMac. I don't, because my iMac, I don't want that. I really don't want that.
I think there's an open question there, and I'm curious to see how. I mean, the Surface Studio obviously is a big foray into that. I'm curious to see if that ends up being compelling or not, right? Like, that's... Everything is, to a certain degree, I agree with you that it seems counterintuitive, and on a desktop, it doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense in the way that we use desktops. That said, there's always the possibility that the way we use these things changes somewhat, or there is some feature so compelling that it makes it worthwhile. I tend to agree with you that it makes way more sense on a laptop, and this all sort of grew out of me hanging out with several of my friends who had touchscreen laptops, and they were all like raving about them. Now, you know, I don't know, that's not universal necessarily, and it's also something that is it's a novelty. It might wear off. At least one of them is my girlfriend, who just got a touchscreen laptop like in the last 2 or 3 weeks, so we'll see if that ends up being a thing that she continues using, or whether it's just knowing that you can do it. But
right.
It is, I think that a lot of Apple's arguments against it don't hold a lot of water, because they talk about like the vertical surfaces for the horizontal surfaces, and it's like, but anybody uses, they're selling an iPad with a keyboard. At that point, you have to do that interaction anyways if you're going back and forth between a keyboard and a touchscreen. It's not like it's crazy. I understand why they don't want to do it, and I'm not suggesting, like, as much as that article said, like, they might be missing out on some opportunities, I'm not trying to advocate that they need to do this or die, right? Like, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there's something interesting happening there, in that people are doing that both between tablets with keyboard interfaces and on the Windows side, where you know, Microsoft has been making that more available. And I'm curious. Like, I there's something happening there. Is there something Apple could do to take advantage of that? I don't know. They seem to see those two lines as very different things, and that's fair.
What I see, so my daughter uses a Chromebook with a touchscreen, because I had it, and she uses it. That's basically it. It's amazing. That's what kids do. It's like, here's old tech, I'll just use it. I'm like, all right, fine, good. And what I found is that she's not using the touchscreen for serious interface interaction, right? She's using the trackpad and the keyboard for serious interface interaction. But, and this would be my argument agreeing with you about Apple putting touchscreens in their devices, is we're not asking for a world where somebody can just sit there and work in Photoshop while running their finger across their laptop screen. Maybe some people will do that or try to do that, but that's not really what we're saying. I think the most common interaction, especially since we are all now trained to do this, the first time I used a MacBook Pro with Touch Bar, I used the Touch Bar and immediately pivoted my hand up to touch the screen where I wanted to click. And then I was like, oh no, I need to move my hand down to the trackpad and move the mouse cursor up there. It's the little stuff like that where you're breaking the metaphor, and it's a metaphor that We all, or, you know, the metaphor is broken by the act of touch. We all are now thinking about direct interface interactions with our computers, with our devices. So for me, looking at what my daughter does, a lot of it is literally, I want to be able to touch the screen and flick that web page up, or, or tap on that OK button, or, you know, or
pinching to zoom is one of the ones because it's so much more intuitive than using a keyboard.
And you can get
mouse.
It exactly to that thing, or swiping in notification center or something like that. Little, like, right? Not necessarily I'm going to double click on a folder and bring it up, and then I'm going to tap and drag to make the window bigger and all that. It's like, I don't think people want to do that, but I think what's happening now is, even if you are comfortable with your keyboard and your trackpad, there are those moments when you forget what you're doing and you reach up to the screen to do just a, you know, a quick flick or something like that, and it didn't do anything. And now, is it enough to rethink the Mac's interface and build in new technology and all of that?
Maybe not.
I don't know, but at some point I start to think, why not? Like, why not do it?
The prevalence of touch. That's the thing that got me in this thinking about this is, touch is clearly the most prevalent interface. I mean, everyone is carrying smartphones, with the exception of crazy people who email me and don't have any cell phones.
Yeah, I was going to say, other than that guy.
What a weird email.
He thinks touch is a fad? Fine, whatever.
Yeah, okay, sure, whatever. But like, you know, iPads, iPhones, touch has been a huge revolution. That is what it comes down to for me.
Yeah,
it's impossible to argue it hasn't been.
People are used to touching screens now. I mean, that's the bottom line, right? People are used to touching
screens. You hear all these
stories
about kids going up to TVs and like swiping at them,
right?
Because
they
don't understand, right? That's a thing. It's clearly a thing that people understand how to do. And so, you know, again, I come down to you, like, why not? Like, it's just an alternative. It doesn't mean you have to do everything through your computer via touch.
Because I will tell you, my daughter absolutely doesn't do everything through her computer via touch. But there are moments when she'll be like, you know, flick on the screen or something. It's rare.
I don't want to take anybody's keyboard or mouse or trackpad, right? Like, I don't want to do away with those. But, you know, my other argument in that article was, if Apple managed to make a software keyboard that we all felt like reasonably comfortable using, if not like, I think it will never be as good as a physical keyboard, but like, plenty of people use that all the time, and it's the only thing they use, and there are certainly people who type on that as fast as I can type on a physical keyboard. But if they're smart enough to design that, I feel like they're smart enough to be able to design a touch interface that works at least, you know, well enough to use on the Mac. That's basically the bottom line for me.
Well, we'll see what they do. They've been steadfast in keeping their products, you know, the interface approach is separate, but I do wonder. I think the MacBook and the MacBook Pro would be great with a little touchscreen that was just not the focus, right? It was just like, you can do basic interaction with the screen.
People use
swipes
it.
And scrolls and things. And
maybe you'll learn some stuff.
And maybe that's not moving, maybe not even moving the cursor, right? Maybe it's literally just pinch to zoom and scroll and swipe from the sides and stuff. That would be fine.
Multi-touch gestures. There you go.
Exactly.
Right. We've solved some problems or created new problems.
Well, yeah,
that's about par for the course for us.
All right. Well, a little longer than usual, but that's fine because it's been
a little while.
Thank you to everybody out there for listening. This is for subscribers to Six Colors. So thank you for being a subscriber. If you're not a subscriber and somehow listening to this, please become a subscriber. It doesn't cost a lot. It helps us keep the lights on and do this for our living, which we like to do because we don't get paychecks now. We just, you know, do this and other stuff that we also do.
Talk onto the internet and hopefully somebody gives us some money.
Yeah, that's just shout into a bag and see if money rains from the sky. That's the internet in a nutshell. All right, that's great. We'll talk again next week, hopefully this time.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.